That's 212-691-3345.
Dear WBAI listener, we can certainly use a little help from our friends. After years of falling behind under new management, Pacifica has now gotten its financial papers in order and can apply once again for grants. That means WBAI, which is owned by the nonprofit Pacifica Foundation, can also apply for funding. And we are looking for a pro bono grant writer to help our 61-year-old station by writing grants for us. If you have time, expertise, and interest, please contact Bertol, our station manager, at bertol@wbai.org. You'd be helping to ensure the stability and growth of this historic listener-sponsored radio station. With details, please email bertol@wbai.org. That's B-E-R-T-H-O-L-D, bertol@wbai.org, with Grant Ryder in the subject heading. Many thanks. Many, many thanks. This is listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
You are tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org on the web. It's 11:01. Coming up next, Living for the City. Welcome to Living for the City. Living for the City is a program focusing on telling stories, our histories, our perspectives of local communities throughout our area and beyond. If you have lived in New York City for any length of time, you know how difficult it is to get the media to report about a subject in depth, tell the truth, or even cover an issue in certain circumstances. We examine those very issues, especially dealing with the real estate industry and the very powerful lobbyists. We look at housing, land, air, and water use, including sunlight, and we do so truthfully, accurately, and without any conflicts of interest. My name is Michael G. Haskins. I'm the program host and executive producer of the program. The senior producer is Jillian Jonas, whom I've worked with since back in 2014, and I am really very proud of the collaboration and relationship that we have built and developed over these years around this program. Before I go any further and introduce my guests, I want to introduce, familiarize you, for some of you, to the concept of Sankofa. Sankofa is a word in the Akan, Twi, and Fante languages of Ghana that translates literally meaning to retrieve, go back and get. And just like the Sankofa bird that is looking back over its shoulder to see where it has come from, we look back in history to see where we've come from, to better understand how we exist in this current moment in 2021 and how we can chart a course for the future. And on this day in peace and social justice history, September 8th, 1756, Colonel John Armstrong and troops under his command destroyed the Indian village of Kittanning. The corporation of the city of Philadelphia awarded a silver medal to Armstrong and his officers for their action. And finally, on this day in peace and social justice history, September 8th, 1941, in Norway, 2,000 workers in the shipyards went on strike against diversion of milk, quote, depriving mothers and babies, unquote, to military use by the German soldiers in Finland. In retaliation, Oslo was placed under a 7 o'clock nightly curfew, after which transportation was stopped, public meetings prohibited, radios seized, dancing forbidden, Boy Scouts, Girl Guides, and Salvation Army organizations were all dissolved. And that wraps up Sankofa in this day in peace and social justice history. And my colleague on the previous encore program, Equal Rights and Justice, Mimi Rosenberg, Mimi mentioned that here at WBAI, my belief, she says, in you and this station, and I do, in that order, belief in you and this radio station, because you, those of you listening right now, have supported this station for years and years and years. And that permits me, it permits us, to have the guests that we have, to have the conversations that we have, to talk about issues that affect our lives in a way that might not be possible, or certainly it isn't possible to have these conversations with city officials and people in government in this city and in this state in many circumstances. In any event, moving on, I just wanted to mention that starting out and thanking you and letting you know, those of you who are new, that this is a commercial-free and listener-supported radio station, and we have been so in the center of the FM dial in New York City for 61 years, thanks to you. And the President of the United States, President Biden, was in town. He's been in the region over the past week or so, the past couple of days, few days, touring and looking at the aftermath of conditions. So the disastrous flooding and related conditions caused by Hurricane Ida last week, where at least 8 New Yorkers living in basement apartments died, proved several things. Among them, that New York City's government is not prepared for upcoming climate catastrophes, in spite of what the city says or has planned. Living for the City focused a segment in the spring on the de Blasio administration's answer to future giant storm surges and rising sea levels anticipated because of climate change in its East Side Coastal Resiliency Plan, ESCR. We featured our next two guests who represent the substantial opposition to this plan over issues like the destruction of East River Park, coastal floodplains, transparency and accountability, and, of course, real estate and gentrification. Now, In the context of IDA and other issues, many of these of those objections seemed prescient. Tommy Loeb and Dr. Amy Berkoff are both steering committee members of East River Park Action, IRPA, who have returned to catch us up to speed. Welcome back to both of you, Tommy Loeb and Amy, Dr. Berkoff. How are you?
Thank you, Michael. Thanks Very for inviting
good.
Us
and
back.
Thank you, Michael, yes. for inviting us on.
Yes, we absolutely are delighted to have you back, and this is the perfect time to bring you back. Let's start, Tommy Loeb, if you don't mind, what contractors and New York City's comptroller's role and the city ignoring it. What about these contractors? I mean, he's been hearing it this morning and throughout the past couple of days as the city is, trying to claw its way back. I should say the city, I say residents throughout our area trying to claw its way back after Ida. What about these contractors?
Well, to just step back a second, the city put out a bid for about $1.2 billion for the section of Eastside Coastal Resiliency from Montgomery Street to 14th Street. And that bid was delayed six times for unknown reasons. We don't know. We were never provided the information why it was delayed. And then ultimately, the city accepted a bid. They only received two bids. Out of all the companies that do work in this area, mm-hmm. only two companies bid on this project. Mm. One bid was by a company called Tully Construction. They have some background in this area, and their bid was $150 million over the city's estimated bid on the project. The winning bid was by a company called IPC Associates, and they are an amalgamation, a consortium of companies that were cobbled together to meet the qualifications that the city had set forth for the project, and they were $55 million over the projected bid. And under city contract law, the city must accept the low bid. So the city accepted the low bid, and then there's a process by which the comptroller has a very limited role in reviewing the bid, but does get to review the bid and then ask questions if he has any, and then either approve it or not approve it.
Mm.
Well, the comptroller had some serious questions about the contractor and the registration under the city's requirements of the subcontractors that they were including in the bid.
Mm-hmm.
And to our knowledge, the city never completed, or the contractor never completed, the registration, which is meant to ferret out corruption, bad contractors, lack of experience, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So the mayor then can ignore the comptroller's response.
Mm.
And basically, that's what happened.
That's what happened.
The mayor did not respond to our knowledge. We submitted a FOIL to find out what knowledge went, what information went back and forth. But then the mayor just overrode the comptroller and approved the contract.
Okay, let me stop you there before I move on and bring up some other issues and talk to Dr. Berkoff, ask her a couple of questions. Why only two? You said there were two that put these bids in. Why only two, and what work were they going to do?
Well, we don't know why only two. They city told us all along that they had pre-qualified numerous bidders mm. for this project who were capable of doing the work. But in the end, Only two decided to bid on the project. And that's a question we would like to answer and have answered, but have not been able to do so. And the work is the entire destruction of 46 acres of East River Park, 1,000 trees just in general, and then to put 1 million tons of landfill on top of the destroyed park and then build a new park on top of that. And for whatever reason, a lot of contractors decided that that was not a project, or because of the engineering, or, you know, we don't know. For some reason, they chose not to bid on it.
Yes, by all means, Dr. Burkhoff, please, Amy Burkhoff, please enter in and talk about, join the conversation. And I'm certainly interested in what you had to say about the work that they did, or that they were going to
do. So the city basically sold this particular alternative, which is the most expensive and most destructive alternative, on the basis of it being the fastest and the most constructible alternative. And so they have proposed an extremely aggressive time schedule, which is something that they talk about in the value engineering report, how this might not necessarily be realistic. They've proposed this very aggressive time frame for a work that is unprecedented in its, you know, scope. And then they've built in penalties for not being able to comply with those time schedules that they've set out. So one of our suspicions is that most contractors looked at this and said, we will lose money, even though this is an incredibly expensive job, we will end up losing money on it. It's not as doable as the city would have you think. That's our suspicion. We don't have any evidence of that.
Dr. Burkhoff, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but you mentioned penalties. And I think I understand this. Maybe some of the listeners do. Maybe they don't. Could you just outline just briefly what a penalty in this situation might be?
I don't really know, but I think that there are financial incentives for meeting particular benchmarks, and then there would be financial penalties for not meeting particular benchmarks, and Tommy may know more about that particular aspect.
Any insights into the penalties, Tommy?
Well, Tommy just as Amy just explained, that built in is if, for example, the project is supposed to be done in 1 year, and every day after 1 year, it's not completed, there are very large financial penalties imposed on the contractor.
Okay, I thought so. I just wanted to be clear in my own mind and for the listeners as well. Tommy Loeb and Dr. Amy Burkhoff are steering committee, both are steering committee members of the East River Park Action. I had been doing some reading over the last week about an alienation lawsuit. Can either of you explain what this alienation lawsuit is?
Well, alienation is a New York state law. We're very privileged in New York to have very strict laws that guard our parks from development or destruction. And one of the things that we feel is that the total destruction of East River Park certainly qualifies under the alienation law. So we have a lawsuit that we started against the city on the fact that they did not apply to the state legislature. They have to go to the state legislature and get approval for any work that would be done in a park. And they must also supply mitigation issues when they do destroy a park. For example, alternative recreation, financial resources to the community, et cetera. So we lost in round one in our local Supreme Court, but right now, in fact, somebody known to BAI, Arthur Schwartz, is our attorney on that case, is appealing, and we expect that appeal to be heard sometime in the end of September or October.
All right, so we'll follow that and get further.
I'd like to add a little bit more on that. Hold on for a second,
Dr. Berkoff. Hold on. We'll come to you straight away. Go ahead, finish up, Tommy. Tommy Loeb.
No, I just wanted to say, I wanted Amy to explain a little bit about what we discovered.
Excellent.
And, you know, when we last spoke, this, you know, one of the things we were doing was the city had denied the existence of a value engineering study. We submitted a FOIL and then went to court, and we got a redacted engineering study with hundreds of pages blacked out. We then continued the litigation, and we got a mostly unredacted report. And I'd like Amy to explain what we found in that unredacted report regarding alienation.
Dr. Amy Berkoff.
So basically, first I want to just talk a little bit about the structure of what they did to come up with this report. There was a company called Strategic Value Engineers from the Midwest that came out for a site visit in February. And then in March, they came back for a five-day workshop. And this is an engineering workshop, so it's only, you know, including engineering perspectives. There's nothing about the environment. There's nothing about public health. And they start the workshop with sort of generating creative ideas. And then they had an evaluation phase, voting on ideas to be developed into value alternatives. And they had 205 creative ideas, 26 of which were developed into value alternatives. And the attendees, when they voted, included, you know, basically lots of engineers on the technical team, three people from New York City Office of Management and Budget, one from Parks, two from Office of Resiliency, two from Department of Transportation, and one from DDC and one from the mayor's office. So nobody from Con Ed, which is, you know, one of the main obstacles that we've faced in talking about this whole project. When they came up with their list of 26 value alternatives, seven of them actually discussed alienation. And they either said, no, this one is no good, because this is going to increase the need for alienation, or more commonly, they said, this is a better plan because it's going to decrease our need for state alienation. So this was something that they were really thinking about very seriously as they evaluated all of these different ideas for the plan that they were going to propose. And then ultimately, when they did their feasibility analysis, this was the following month in April, they basically said, because the alternative proposal, that's their preferred, you know, cut everything down and add 8 feet of fill proposal, because this proposal protects East River Park, it is believed that this will be deemed to be serving a park purpose and therefore not require alienation.
Yeah, I see.
So they were really focused on avoid, you know, for reasons that really seem very mysterious, they were quite focused on avoiding state oversight. And the only thing we can really come up with, other than historic, you know, disagreements between the state and the city, is they actually removed $300 million in mitigation from the budget when they decided that they would not, when their new plan would not require alienation. So this was an idea that would save them $300 million. So even though they went to a more expensive plan, it's no longer going to things that will help the members of the community, which is what would happen under state land alienation. There would be mitigation that would be intended to enable members of the community to withstand even a temporary loss of their parkland, and that is what they took out during the feasibility analysis.
Okay, Dr. Berkoff, Dr. Amy Berkoff, I want to stay with you for another moment. How the East Side Coastal Resiliency, Howard not protect against hurricane-type rain events, including the time frame and massive flooding? Can you speak a bit about that?
Well, so there's basically three things that we have to be concerned about in terms of future climate change and flooding. And one of those is storm surge, like we had with Sandy. And another one is sea level rise. But, you know, so storm surge we had with Sandy, that's still a very rare event, although it may increase in frequency.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There is sea level rise, which is, you know, we have the latest data now out from IPCC, and, you know, we are certainly expecting considerable sea level rise and probably more than the city's current plan would even offer any protection against. But that's not immediate, okay? So we have one that's rare, one that's not immediate. The thing that's really pressing is this apparent increase in extreme rain events.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The ESCR project was in no way developed to address extreme rain events, and
mm-hmm.
it won't do anything to help us as far as we can tell.
Right.
I mean, basically, you're elevating the park, but that is not going mm-hmm. to help with the water that accumulates passing over the city, which will actually not have as many pathways to drain out into our waterways. And so that could potentially even make problems with the sewer system even worse.
Of course.
Tommy may have a little bit more...
Right. Tommy Loeb, and I'm speaking with Tommy Loeb and Dr. Amy Burkhoff, Dr. Burkhoff from the biology department at the City College of New York, CUNY. They're both steering committee members of the East River Park Action, or ERPA. Where's East River Park for people in other areas of the city that may not know? Let's focus on it and tell people where it is. You have some events that I'm going to be asking you about when we finish our conversation, and I want people to know exactly where to go and where the location is.
Well, East River Park, as described, runs from Montgomery Street on the Lower East Side, on the east side of the FDR Drive, all the way to 14th Street is officially the park. Then there is an additional section from 14th Street to 25th Street, which is called Stuyvesant Cove by many people, but that is not officially mapped as parkland. But that part of the project is currently underway and is also a little bit controversial. Let me raise one other issue that the controller raised
in
his questioning of the contract, and that was the city has a goal in all its contract of reaching 30% minority women-owned business in all contracts. And the first contract to be let, the 14th to 25th Street section, only had a 16% requirement by DDC for the contractor. And one of the big things that Councilwoman Carlina Rivera said and used as one of her reasons for supporting this project was going to be the jobs and the contracts that were going to come to the local community as a result of this $1.75 billion project. Well, we recently uncovered that in the section that's currently underway, they have hired one person, that's one, literally, from the community, and they have no information on the percentage of minority women-owned business that contracts have been awarded to.
Mm.
And that's the other issue that the controller raised and never was responded to either.
Mm-hmm. Well, while we're talking about city government, people in city government, Councilman Brannon, chair of Waterfront and Resiliency Committee, wants to hold oversight hearing, and Corey Johnson won't approve. Is this so? Why is this so, do you believe?
Well, that is true. Councilman Brannon has told us that he heads the City Council Waterfront and Resiliency Committee. And now, even since Ida, he has been very outspoken on the fact that the city is underprepared for a rain-type event, which we have been saying now for a long time. And we think that this project deserves an oversight hearing. And the way the council protocol works is, even if the council, the chair of a committee, wants to hold a hearing, he needs the permission of the council speaker, who is Corey Johnson.
Yes.
And to this date, and this is an unusual, the Village Sun, to their credit, contacted Corey Johnson's staff and asked them, would he allow a hearing? And this is the quote from his staff: "We declined to comment on this." So they won't even comment
on him,
or make give an excuse or a rationale for not holding a hearing. Mm-hmm. They just won't comment.
They won't comment. All right. Well, that's quite interesting, and I'm glad that you brought that out. Let me just reorient listeners. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. The name of this program is Living for the City. I'm your host, Michael G. Haskins, and I'm in conversation today with Dr. Amy Berkoff, the biology department, with the biology department of CCNY and CUNY, part of the CUNY system, and Tommy Loeb. Both of them are steering committee members of East River Park Action. I can't believe so much time has elapsed already. We're almost 30 minutes into our conversation. I don't want to manipulate much more of your time, but I do have a couple of other items I'd like to go over with you, if you don't mind. Speaking of being prepared, Dr. Berkoff, what about evacuation and shelter plans for the area? I remember during Superstorm Sandy, I visited a shelter in the area in which I live. I wasn't really permitted to have access as a reporter or producer of a radio station, but I was able to get in and talk to some people about how folks were making out and dealing with the situation being in these shelters. What about the plans now for your area, for that area down in the southern part of our city?
I don't really have details on that. There's an organization called Lower East Side Ready that is supposed to be helping people prepare to deal with emergencies in the future. My position has always been that just like anybody living in an earthquake zone or a volcanic area or a place that is prone to tsunamis, people tornadoes, that are living in a floodplain have to be prepared to evacuate. Nobody likes to hear that because there are long intervals between the problems.
Right, people forget.
But if you live in a very active area like that, you have to be prepared to have a plan to move on out. And I don't think that that's something that people are very responsive to in our area. I actually was talking to somebody yesterday who lives in Queens, and she was saying, well, you know, they prepared for Henri because they heard that it was a hurricane. But when Ida came, they just heard it was rain, and they heard something about a lot of rain, but that didn't really mean anything to them. And so they didn't make any kinds of preparations for that. And so that's something that has to be dealt with in the messaging. That's one reason why I'm trying to emphasize that we need to be thinking about storm surge and sea level rise and extreme rain, which, of course, after last week, people are going to be more inclined to do.
Right.
And I don't know, Tommy, if you know more about evacuation plans since you are living right on the river.
Well, only that, you know, one of the things that we've been also trying to highlight is people should realize there's a separate $350 million resiliency plan currently almost completed and underway for all the NYCHA buildings on the Lower East Side. However, that plan only protects the infrastructure. and would require, in the event of a major storm, which would flood the area, the evacuation of about 18,000 people from the NYCHA buildings. And there is no plan, essentially, for that, which is unfortunate.
It is distressing, actually.
But there is no real plan.
Right. When I travel the FDR Drive, I see all of the locations, Stuytown and so on, and looking at that and just thinking about what you're saying, hearing you say that there is no plan for evacuation of just the NYCHA houses, not to mention these other residents that live in that area. Well, we're just about ready to close out this portion of the program. I mentioned earlier that you have a events that will be coming up, and I want you to talk about some things that are coming up tomorrow over the weekend. Would you both either start that discussion?
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for starting out the program with an acknowledgement of the date and what happened to the indigenous community. One of the things that, by the way, that people in history don't know about East River Park and Corlears Park, which is the park attached to it on the east side of the river, is that it was the site of a massacre, a Lenape massacre.
Yes.
And one of the things we are looking at to try to actually identify the site. And the other thing that East River Park does is, before we start any public meeting or every meeting, we do a land acknowledgement to acknowledge those who came before us. And that leads in, I'll start with the first event, which is tomorrow from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Henry Street Abrams Art outside, the Abrams Theater. And it will include a ceremony, including indigenous people, Lower East Side residents, and it will be outdoors with a ceremonial fire. And so that's 6:30 to 8:30 in front of Abrams at 466 Grand Street. Amy, you want to discuss the other event?
Something going on the September 11th at the amphitheater, I believe.
So
the 1,000 people, 1,000 trees
event is 1,000 people for 1,000 trees.
Yes.
And this takes place at 11 a.m. at the East River Park Amphitheater.
All right. So that's Thursday. That is tomorrow.
Pardon?
September. I said, so that's Thursday, September 9th. That Tommy was talking about at the Abrams Arts Center, 466 Grand Street, the Lower East Side. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And Dr. Berghoff, you were talking about on September 11th, Saturday, September 11th, the East River Park Amphitheater, 1,000 people, 1,000 trees, or 1,000 trees, 1,000 people. Where's that located, just for people?
That's a little south of Grand Street.
Okay.
Do you know, Tommy, exactly where the amphitheater would be?
It's just in the park. There's an overpass just south of Grand Street that leads right to the amphitheater.
Okay, that is great. And thank you so much for your time this morning. Is there anything else that you'd like to share? And could you give some contact information for the organization, if you don't mind?
I have something else to share.
Please do.
So some of the members in our group are out at Gowanus today talking, you know, to attend a hearing or a meeting about the proposed redevelopment at Gowanus. And these are some of the points that they're talking about, which I think are also really important for the East River coastal resiliency. So they think that wet weather analysis of sewer system capacity needs to be included in all environmental impact statements going forward, including cumulative analysis of these sewer sheds. And they also are suggesting that a review of recent environmental impact statements performed over the past 5 years should ensure the inclusion and accuracy of climate change analysis, environmental justice analysis, and wet weather analysis. And I think that we fully agree with those goals, and this is one of the reasons why we really think it's important to have an oversight hearing on the ESCR project before they, you know, make this complete boondoggle disaster.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up. Additional item, Dr. Amy Berkoff. Thank you so much, and Tommy Loeb, both of you from the members, I should say, of the East River Park Action, or ERPA. And how can people get in touch?
Can I put
is there a number?
One last plug for our website.
Yes, please.
Which has, if people want to get into the weeds and see a lot of information that we both uncovered and are trying to uncover, they should go to eastriverparkaction.org.
That's great. eastriverparkaction.org. And again, I thank you both for being on the program this morning, and we look forward to talking to you again. And as these issues develop, you know, there's another storm. It's not the massive storm that we just had from Ida, but there's another rain condition coming our way. So these things are upon us. And I thank you very much, both of you, for being here today.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
All right. This is Living for the City over WBAI. We're listener-sponsored. We are commercially free. And we are so because of you. I started out the program talking about that. And, you know, if you've listened to me for any length of time, you know I talk about this rather regularly, talking about the radio station and its commercial-free status over the years. If you are able to make a contribution in support of this program and this radio station, our pledge line is always open, and you can make a call anytime, 12 o'clock at night, or you don't have to make it 12 o'clock at night, really. If you can do it this morning, today, right now, call us, 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. And you can do whatever is comfortable for you. Make whatever contribution you can. Some people make large contributions, becoming major donors to the radio station and to the work that we do as individuals and groups, and the collaborations with each other that we have. Or you can just say, I want to make a $25 contribution. I want to become a sustaining member for $10 a month. Or I want a particular book or CD. The previous program, my colleague Mimi Rosenberg was offering a series of CDs on Jim Crow. Well, you can do that. Or the book that I offered the last time I did a particular fundraiser, I offered the book Infinitum by Tom Fielder. And the book Infinitum for a $60 contribution. You can do that. But you have to get in contact with me for that. And that's really simple. When I say get in contact with me, I'm going to give the phone number out, and I want you to call me after the program. There's a couple of things I want you to do. Call me after the program if you have a family member, an elder, that you've been talking to and you've done recordings with. Many of you know the recordings that I've done with my father before he passed away, and some elder cousins in my family, aunts, uncles, and cousins. And I brought them to those conversations, those beautiful conversations that I had about their lives growing up in the Old Dominion, some in the 40s, my father's in the 30s. So if you have those conversations recorded and you would like to share them with the WBAI audience, contact me after the show at 212-209-2877. I'll pick up and we can talk. 212-209-2877. Now, if you'd like to, how much time do we have left? If you'd like to talk about any of the things that we have discussed thus far on the program, my guests have left the air right now, but you can call 212-209-2. Why am I forgetting this? Because I'm thinking of the pledge line. 212-209-2877 for on-air calls. I don't do this a lot because I'm trying to pack as much as I can into the 55 minutes that I have. But we do have a few minutes left. I talked last week about my time when I was down south and I was fishing with my father-in-law and my reaction and how I was feeling after I caught a few fish. Now, my cousins and my older cousins and my father told me quite a bit, and I have these recordings of working in a slaughterhouse. And I thought about playing that, but, you know, it's graphic. And I don't think you want to hear about the slaughtering of an animal. So I decided against that. But, you know, it's just a powerful story, hearkening back to another time and when we all had to, if you wanted to eat meat, and let's be frank about it, we all did, many of us did, not all of us, but we did, you had to slaughter the animal yourself. Now, many native cultures, when they do slaughter an animal, it's a specific ritual that is involved. It's not the situation that we have been so accustomed to in this country over the last years. Well, let me have those lamb chops or that pork chop. Let me have that roast over there. No, you had to go out and slaughter a chicken or a cow or whatever. So in any event, I've had those conversations, and I would like to bring them to the air, but because of the nature of, you know, nobody wants to hear that. But the conversation and hearing those tones and what actually was being said and told to me, I think is worth a listen. But in any event, we'll revisit it. Don't forget to call me. Call me after the show if you have some recordings with your elders and you'd like to bring them to the air. Shana Tova. It is the day of shouting or blasting, and that was at a pop-up restaurant, a pop-up event yesterday in Brooklyn that my wife went to and grabbed. She grabbed the audio, and you know I'm always about bringing audio. It was something about this guy, restaurateur, that grabbed a number of peppers, unique and rare peppers from New Mexico, I believe, and brought them across country and had all kinds of exotic dishes and shared them with the audience. That just about wraps up the program. That is Living for the City. Happy New Year. Good year to you. Head of the year. I'll see you tomorrow, next week. Not sure. But let's go out with a little of Alamode. A family. That's Family, Jennifer Hudson, that remix there, and before that, Alamode. Here over listener sponsored WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. I thank you so much for tuning in. Remember, I will take your calls after put on the next program. Coming up is our newscast. But after I put on the next program, I will take your phone calls. So stay tuned for that at 212. Where are we now, ladies and gentlemen? 212-209-2877.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, September 8th. Here are some headlines. The largest Confederate statue in the United States has been removed from its pedestal in Richmond, Virginia, the former capital of the Confederacy. The 12-ton bronze statue of Robert E. Lee has been in place for more than 131 years and is widely seen as a symbol of racial injustice. A crowd of about 200 people nearby chanted, "What do we want? Justice. When do we want it? Now." As a work crew using a heavy-duty crane hoisted the statue off its 40-foot pedestal. The work crew then began cutting it into pieces for relocation to a storage facility. Officials say the statue will be placed in storage at a state-owned facility until a decision is made as to its final disposition. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed new voting restrictions into law on Tuesday that place unnecessary and discriminatory burdens on Texans trying to access the ballot box. Already, the new voting laws are the target of at least three federal lawsuits contending the changes will have a disproportionate impact on people of color and voters with disabilities. Texas now joins a growing list of Republican-controlled states that have tightened voting rules in response to former President Trump's big lie of 2020 voting fraud. Democratic lawmakers yesterday renewed calls for federal voting legislation and the elimination of the filibuster. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem signed an executive order on Tuesday banning clinicians from prescribing medication abortions through telemedicine. The Republican governor declared that abortion pills may only be prescribed or dispensed by a doctor who is licensed in South Dakota for an in-person examination. South Dakota has only one abortion clinic, according to online registries. The move comes on the heels of a near-total ban on abortion in Texas, and Governor Noem is not the only Republican following Texas's lead in recent days. GOP officials in at least six other states, including Arkansas, Florida, and South Carolina, have moved to review or amend their abortion laws. A major earthquake struck near the Mexican resort city of Acapulco, killing at least one person and shaking buildings in Mexico City more than 230 miles away. The U.S. Geological Survey, which registered the quake at a magnitude of 7.0, said significant casualties and damages are likely and impacts are potentially widespread. About 1.6 million people were left without power as of Tuesday evening, the Federal Electricity Commission said in a statement. Earthquakes are not uncommon in Mexico because of its location on the edge of the North American tectonic plate. More than 9,500 people were killed in and around Mexico City.